After a long and brutal campaign season, it's time to clear our minds, and what better way to do that than get outdoors? This Saturday marks the beginning of Wisconsin's 9-day gun deer season, and more than 100,000 hunters are expected to don blaze orange or pink and head out into the woods. This hour, we'll preview the hunt, talk about herd health, get some tips on processing venison, and then discuss an upcoming listening session on water quality in Eau Claire. That's this hour on the West Side. I'm Rich Kramer. Thanks for joining us this Monday morning. As always, for the West Side Outside segments, we are joined by the outdoor guys, and they are Joe Knight. Joe Knight is an outdoor writer with work featured in today's Eau Claire Leader Telegram, and he joins me in studio. Joe Knight, welcome to the program.
Thanks for inviting me.
My pleasure. Also, we have Dave Carlson. He's the other part of the dynamic duo that we call the outdoor guys. He's a writer for Wisconsin Outdoor News, also a creator and longtime host of Northland Adventures. Dave Carlson, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
It's good to have you guys here. Also, we're joined by a host of special guests, including joining us by phone is Mike Zechmeister. He is with the DNR in the Spooner office. He is the Northern Region Program Manager, also a biologist with the DNR. Mike Zechmeister, thanks for joining us.
Excited to be on the line.
Always a pleasure to have you. We're excited as well. Joining us in studio, we have Scott Thede. He is a conservation warden with the DNR based here in Eau Claire. Scott Thede, thanks for being here.
Yeah, a bit of a cold today, so I think that's my radio voice today.
That's, you know, whenever I get sick, after the sickness
sounds
is passed, yeah, it gets nice and low. Listeners, we'd love to hear from you. If you're planning on heading out into the woods, or even if you're not, let us know what you think about the deer hunt, about some of the regulation changes, if you're apprised of them. Also, a little later, we're going to talk about processing venison. We're going to have Bob Adrian at around 10:30 on the program. He's the owner of Rump's Butcher Shop in Altoona. And then later, towards the end of the hour, we're going to speak with Tressie Camp. She's an attorney with Midwest Environmental Advocates in Madison. There's going to be a pretty high-ranking official with the EPA in Eau Claire to hear folks' concerns about water quality. The number to call in, 1-800-228-5615. So, Scott Thede, let's start with you. What are some of the big new rules that people might not be aware of unless they've, you know, studied whatever they can find online with regard to the regulations?
Yeah, we always have changes for the gun deer season. I've been doing this 28 years. There's never been a year where the rules have not changed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to, you know, there's a few points I'll make, but we want to understand that some rules have not change. So think of that. And one of them would be you do need a hunting license. It's just that with the new Go Wild system, that form of a proof, we call it, that you have a license has changed. We see a lot of conservation cards, some driver's license. You can have the paper copy of your hunting license. Anything that shows proof, even a PDF on a smartphone. But with that fact that people are not used to actually bringing a paper license necessarily, there's some sometimes they're forgetting to bring their carcass tags. Now, we've had carcass tags for deer for many years, and nothing's changed in that area. They're paper carcass tags. We have to remind folks to bring their carcass tags with them, their gun deer, and we've had archery season going on for a bit. Bring those tags with you. We recommend a little baggie. The DNR office in Eau Claire has been giving away some little Ziploc bags with a zip tie-in and a pencil. The validation of the tag has not changed. Always immediately validate that carcass tag before moving the animal or field dressing the animal. What has changed is how you validate the tag. Now you write the day of harvest on the tag. Again, it's a paper tag. You write the day of harvest. You circle AM or PM. Now you can put that bag back in, or that carcass tag back in the bag. You do not have to attach the carcass tag to a deer. That's new this year. Because they're paper tags, they could easily, weather would affect them more so than what we had in the past. So just remember, what has not changed? Tags are required. You still have to validate the tag. You still have to have the tag with you while hunting. The attaching the tag, carcass tag, to the deer does not have to occur unless you leave the deer unattended. So, again, you have the tag with you, you put it in your pocket, you field dress it, you might drag the deer out. But if you, as a hunter whose name is on that tag, leave that deer unattended, you best attach that tag. And again, if it's in a bag and you got that zip tie or a string handy, tie it to the antler, attach it to the ear like we've always done in the past. So again, there's a lot of rule changes, but think back of how things were. Those rules have not changed. We have no back tags this year. That's another reason why we're sometimes finding folks forgetting to bring their paper license or their carcass tags with them. Traditionally, they were always kept in a back peg holder on their back. Mm-hmm. Now they have to remember that's not the law anymore. No back tags, but license and carcass tags are still very important.
That's pretty interesting, the no back tag changes. Gentlemen?
A lot of people not happy with that either.
I haven't heard. This did not come from the Conservation Congress or the Natural Resources Board.
I don't understand why it would why people would be unhappy about it. It seems like it might be easier for
them. We were among the last states to get rid of back tags. I know that. But they were used in identification. The most notorious, of course, was a few years back when they helped identify the killer of hunters during the deer season.
Sure.
Up at Rice Lake. And there have been many instances over the years where those tags have been used for prosecuting trespass situations and other violations and so forth. So, but they were also, it was, you could lose them.
Oh, yeah.
You could be walking through the woods.
And they could scratch on the back of a tree when you're drawing your bowstring.
Yeah.
Sure.
But yeah, there's also the thought that you might behave a little better when you have
when you're identified with a giant number on your
back? Yeah, it hasn't always kept me out of trouble, but there's that thought, yeah.
Okay. Listeners, if you have a question or a comment, give us a call at 1-800-228-5615.
Oh, you might. I found two. Excuse me. I'm about to head up north to go bow hunting, so I have this copy. See this flimsy copy paper here?
It's just regular paper.
And I had to get out a scissors, too, and cut it out from the – you're finding people have to do this, Scott, too?
It's printed off on a large piece of paper initially, but you can cut out that carcass tag.
It's like going back to kindergarten. Then I had to put it in a plastic sandwich bag, so I think I'm all ready now.
So, Joe, you wrote an article for the Telegram that showed up in today's, above the fold even, on the front page, today's Leader Telegram. So, you spoke with some hunters. What were their thoughts on this stuff?
Generally, I spoke with a member of the Conservation Congress, and he said the feedback they've been getting is not especially positive, although we tend to hear human nature. We tend to hear complaints more than
when anything changes.
But, yeah, we were all used to the plasticized. I was out in Montana this fall hunting, and they give you the heavy-duty plasticized paper. So when you fold it up and put it in your wallet, it doesn't disintegrate. This is basically copy paper, so... Like you might get off your Xerox at work, so any little bit of spill coffee on it, it gets a little dew on it, and it's going to dissolve. So much less durable.
It'll take some getting used to. And this was, a change that was brought by the legislature, Scott Thede.
Well, the elimination of the back tags was through the state legislature, but there's been some. No doubt the DNR had some input into the new Go Wild system and an opportunity to provide more flexibility to people. If you lose that carcass tag or your license, it's now much more easy to just print off a new one. Mm-hmm. Or you might get a conservation card that's a very durable plastic card with the subject's name on it. And we actually have an app on our smartphones as wardens. We can scan that card or scan the back of a hunter or fisherman's driver's license, and so it is much more efficient, much more information readily available.
If we have two gun deer buck tags, if we have duplicates in our possession at the same time in the field, then we're going to get into hot water with you guys, right?
Well, the rule, obviously, it's much more efficient in the fact that you can have multiple copies of things. So, you know, like license, you can have them all over the place, so you always have one handy. If one gets wet, you can print a new one. With carcass tags, they too could be printed multiple copies of the same tag, but the law does not allow a hunter to have more than one copy of a specific unique carcass tag while in the field. That's obviously to eliminate the use of multiple tags.
But now, am I going to get – I bought a Petron license, and I think two antlerless tags came with that. Am I going to get in trouble? I have them both in the same plastic bag here. Am I going to get in trouble for having two?
Well, each carcass tag is identified with a unique number. So when they say unique tag, they mean with the same identical number on them. Hunters have the opportunity when they buy a hunting license, a gun license, or an archery license to get, depending on what county you're purchasing these tags for, anywhere from 0 to 3 antlerless tags are available. And that's a good good topic as well. Antlerless tags are, the buck tags are statewide tags, but they're weapon specific. They'll say gun buck tag or archery buck tag. But these antlerless tags, the farmland tags or the bonus tags that folks might have purchased, those are clearly stated as antlerless tags, and they are not weapon specific. You could harvest them with a buck, with a bow or a gun, but there are a lot of lot more details you got to consider. They are specific to county. They're issued for specific harvest in a specific county.
Sure.
The zone of the state, is it a farmland zone or a forest zone? In Eau Claire County here, we have Highway 27 is a divider between a forest and a farmland zone, so make sure your tag is accurate. And also land type. We're finding some situations where hunters, they mean well, but they might have got a public land. By land type, we mean private or public land tag. They may have got a public land antlerless tag. And then a buddy says, hey, I got some time. Let's go hunt my private land. Well, you best consider that your tag for antlerless deer is valid only in public land, if that's what it says on the tag. So pay attention to those details. Lay your tags out. Read them. Make sure you grab the right tag out of the bag when you're about to put it on the deer, that it's the right tag you're using.
And also a change is, of course, farther to our north from Eau Claire, looking north, not a whole lot of antlerless tags up there, correct?
Correct. The far north is buck only, has been for a few years now. Mm-hmm. Just a way to help the deer herd up there. They've had some mild winters, but in the past, real tough winters, and there's some depredation occurring as well, of course. So, mm-hmm. Yep.
Mike Zechmeister, Dave Carlson here. Let's talk about the northern deer herd. What kind of condition is it in?
Well, in the far north, Scott said, we're rebuilding the herd, and that's why we have bucks only in like 9 counties in the far north. But that population's growing, and that's a good thing. That's on purpose. The southern tier of the north, good numbers of deer. We're kind of in what I refer to a baby boomer generation of deer upon us, and that's because we've had 2 mild back-to-back winters. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of fawns were produced, and there should be a lot of yearlings out there.
A lot of my evenings at the cabin up north in Washburn County, I hear clink, 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 acorns falling on the metal garage roof. Mm-hmm. Not so this year.
No, we had it wasn't necessarily a late freeze. It was like in mid-May. What happened here, and this is part of the whole equation, is we had a very early spring green up this last year. So a lot of the plants, including the oak trees, broke dormancy early, and too early, in fact. So a lot of the oaks were flowering when we had that pretty hard freeze in mid-May. So that really affected acorn production.
Acorns very essential to not only the deer, but a diverse group of wildlife.
That's true. And so it's not a really good acorn production year, but typically for deer and for a lot of other wildlife, acorns are kind of a bonus. Acorn crops, you know, historically have not been consistent because of that freeze. And so it's kind of a bonus for deer. But the good news is we had a really good growing season for other plants throughout the year. We had nice periodic rains. We had that early spring green up. And so the fat levels on deer are really, really good. In fact, a buddy of mine over in Oneida County shot a nice doe just last week, and he said he's never seen fat levels as high as he saw in that doe after he butchered it. So there was a lot of great plant growth. So deer are going into the winter in good shape. And, of course, we've had a very mild fall, so that's all great, even though we don't have acorns out there.
Mike, while we're talking about acorns and oak trees, I get conflicting reports, depending on whether I'm talking to foresters or deer hunters. Like Bayfield County is among the areas that is bucks only. But the county forester up there tells me they have an exclosure or enclosure, exclosure, I guess you call it, where they put a fence around the trees and don't let deer go in. That's kind of south of the Ulu Rock. And he says they inside the fence, they get great generation of red oak. Outside, very little for red oak. And the same with white birch, virtually no regeneration outside the exclosure. And he attributes that to a high deer herd. Now, is that just a spotty deer herd, or are the deer hunters right, or is the forester right?
Well, that's a really good question. And it all goes back to, what is a high deer herd? We have seen that the deer herd is growing, even in the northern fringe counties, and some of those counties can't really tolerate a real high density of deer to be able to facilitate oak regeneration and white birch regeneration. So kind of depends upon where you're at.
The deer are hot right now. They were literally hot when the temperatures have been so warm, and I know it slowed the rutting activity. At least that's reports I'm getting from some of the hunters who I know. And what's the situation like up there, the rut? Will there be some animals still in rut come this weekend?
Yeah, I think so, Dave. In fact, I just talked with Greg Kessler from the Brule area, and said there's rutting activity going on now. I was just out on my deer stand yesterday for the last time, granted, before Saturday, because I don't want to spook anything, but there's two active scrapes there. So, I think we're going to be picking up the tail end of the rut this weekend. So that's good news for deer hunters.
Scott Thede, any idea of what's going on down here? Because I'll say I was just driving home from work the other at the end of last week, and I saw a nice little, it was a young buck, but it probably 4 or 6 points, something like that, chasing a doe right across the male parking lot.
Yeah, oh. That's me coughing in the background.
Well, we could go back to you.
Yeah, the deer activity has been strong. We're having a lot of hunters see a lot of deer. How do I sound? Pretty hoarse?
You sound pretty good.
Okay. I know of a young man, a 14-year-old, who shot a nice 8-pointer, about a 170-class buck. Hmm. He was just east of Altoona in the county forest.
Sure.
There's a lot of deer activity, a lot of deer being seen from the road. So, yeah, I think hunters are having a great time.
We should know, too, if you're seeing them in the Mayo parking lot, that Eau Claire has a booming deer population.
It does, huh?
These city fathers would like to see it reduced a bit, but it's
about 5 or 6 metro zones across the state. My son-in-law got one of them.
Would you say metro zones?
Metro zones, right, okay. If you look in the regs.
I think the city is in the process of becoming a metro zone, isn't it?
I'm not sure.
I think, yeah.
I wonder if that up in Superior we have a lot of, that's where I grew up, a lot of rail yards and a lot of, you know, grains that spill out of there. And so the deer are huge there and also near the refinery for some reason. So there had always been hunting within the city limits up there. And I was surprised to find that it wasn't necessarily the case.
Mike, I've got to ask you about the CWD testing going on. What have you had going on in the north?
Yeah, we're testing in the northwest, 4 counties, Washburn, Burnett, Barron and Polk, and that's been going strong. We've been hunters have been turning in deer heads that are 24/7 kiosks that we have set up. We have a whole bunch of them. You can go on our website and just type in CWD sampling. It'll list all those locations. We also have some surveillance going on in the northeast part of the state, so that Oneida Vilas country. and Forest County. So we're collecting heads up there because CWD positive was detected within a game farm, deer farm. It wasn't outside, but that triggered then surveillance in that three-county area.
We should probably mention the Augusta area down here, too, or the Fairchild area, where for the second year they'll be looking for deer heads, particularly a little north of Fairchild, where there we had a deer farm where some deer went AWOL, and that turned out to have a lot of deer with chronic wasting disease. Mm-hmm. And this year the FFA down in Osseo has built some kiosks for hunters to drop off heads after hours. Mm. Also, there's going to be some DNR FAT staff people down in Augusta and at the Fairchild convenience store on Highway 10. And they can, if a hunter doesn't want to cut off the head of his deer, they can make a couple slits
take
and get out
glands.
Get out the glands, you know, the lymph glands, and the hunter can go on his merry way. But they do need people to stop by because you no longer have mandatory registration like we used to at deer stations. You can now do all that by phone or online.
Scott Thede, would you like to add anything?
Well, if my voice can allow me, yes. There's a surveillance area within a 10-mile radius of that captive deer farm by Fairchild. So
right.
Any mature deer, so it has to be a mature buck or doe, the hunter would leave at least 3 inches of neck attached, and the heads are being collected, as Joe mentioned, Augusta Ranger Station, Eau Claire DNR Service Center, there's a kiosk out there, Fairchild Senex, there's some taxidermists as well, Shooting Lane Taxidermy at Fall Creek, Hixton Ridge Taxidermy at Hixton. Now, if a hunter harvests a deer outside of that 10-mile radius by Fairchild, they're welcome to have that tested as well. It's a free service. And again, these kiosks, these taxidermists are all collecting heads. So the biologist may be contacting you if you leave a head in a kiosk, for instance, to get more details. But it takes about, 3 to 5 weeks, I guess, to get a result back.
Mm-hmm. And Mike Zechmeister, how many samples does the DNR want to see throughout this, the 9-day gun deer hunt, but also the archery seasons?
Well,
what are you hoping for?
We have some targets out there, but it's basically as many as we can get. That gives us the best information, especially, as Scott said, mature deer. We're not looking at fawns, but that just gives us a much better handle on if the disease is out there, and if it is out there, what is that prevalence rate?
Mm-hmm.
So as many as we can get. That's what we're telling everybody. We kind of got away from, we got to get 200 heads by county. We kind of got away from that.
And is there a sense that the electronic registration, I've heard some concerns that that's kind of driving down the numbers of samples that the DNR is able to get?
Well, I think it forced us to rethink things a little bit and be a little bit more creative, and that's why we reached out to a lot of taxidermists, so they're on board to be able to collect heads for us, and also these 24/7 kiosks, where they're basically drop-off stations. We're getting some pretty good success in the Northwest and even in the Northeast on folks dropping off heads. So it is very convenient, like Scott said. It's just really important that the hunters fill out that form, because we need to know the location of that deer. That's the most important thing. If you don't include the location, it's just a deer head, then it really means nothing for us.
Yeah, I think Bill Hogseth, the local wildlife manager, said they had collected 60 so far down by Fairchild, which is a good start from bow hunters.
And, and that shows
he's hoping they'll keep going. And it is important. He emphasized you need to have a phone number there because they want to get as close as possible the location of where you shot that deer.
Sure. It seems to show that people, at least some people, still do care very much about CWD, because there was thought that some hunters just didn't seem that concerned about it.
We should maybe say that despite some deer that went AWOL from that deer farm, CWD has not been detected in wild deer in Eau Claire or Clark or Jackson counties, which were all within a 10-mile radius of that.
What about in your neck of the woods, Mike Zechmeister? I mean, it's been how many years now since they found the CWD positive up in Shell Lake?
Yeah, it's been, we're going on a good number of years, and knock on wood, we haven't found anything in the wild deer herd, and we hope to keep it that way. Mm. So that does bring up another point, is whenever we do detect a positive, whether it's in a deer farm or outside, that baiting and feeding ban is in effect. So like for Eau Claire County, for example, baiting and feeding is not allowed, and in those seven counties in the north, baiting and feeding is not allowed.
Then you've got Joe Knight with his article on the front page a deer chomping on a pumpkin.
They ran it with a deer eating a pumpkin, yeah, so I'm glad you brought that
not
up.
Not a wild pumpkin.
Maybe a free-range pumpkin.
Yeah.
We were just talking before we went on air about how hard it is for some people to get over recreational feeding of deer, the little old ladies.
It is a change. Now, by my math, and they could very well be wrong, 61% of the state, county-wise, is basically under a feeding ban. I know there was some kind of an internal review of with regard to the CWD action plan that was done 15 years ago or something like that. But is there any talk within the agency of a statewide feeding ban? I know that would have to be the legislature that would make that decision, but do you think the tide is shifting since so much of the state is already under a de facto feeding ban, Mike?
Yeah, I think the tide is shifting. It sure would be a lot more consistent statewide. Also, baiting and feeding is not in the best interest of the deer herd either. When we had that very severe winter a couple years ago, we actually found dead deer because people thought they needed to help them out by feeding corn. And deer can't handle that. When they have to have a real quick shift to their diet, they have a very complicated system of microorganisms in their stomachs, and they actually die from it. And we also saw a lot of roadkill deer by deer going to feeding stations where people were feeding deer. They were crossing the roads, and they were getting hit by vehicles. Mm. So really, from a feeding perspective, it's not in the best interest of the deer herd. Certainly, we've shown as far as baiting goes, at least in this four-county area in the northwest, our buck kill did not go down at all after that baiting ban went into effect. So, and there's a lot of folks out there that feel this is the best thing, is to have a ban on baiting.
Hmm. Well, with that, let's take our first break. This is the West Side. We're talking about the 9-day gun deer hunt season and all things deer hunting this hour. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Bob Adrian. He's the owner of Rump's Butcher Shop in Altoona, to give us some tips and some background on processing your own deer. This is the West Side. If you've got a question or comment, give us a call at 1-800-228-5615.
Support for WPR is provided by the WHA Radio Arts Programming Endowment Fund, providing funds to help WPR bring quality educational and entertainment programs, like A Prairie Home Companion, to Wisconsin Public Radio listeners. Supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio include Hooper Corporation and Wollersheim Winery. Your business can join our ever-growing list of contributors. Go to WPR.org/sponsor.
I'm Rich Kramer. You're listening to the West Side Outside today on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us this brisk but sunny Monday morning. I'm joined in studio by Joe Knight and Dave Carlson. They are outdoor writers, affectionately known on this program as the Outdoor Guys. Also joining me is Mike Zechmeister. He's a wildlife biologist with the DNR up in Spooner, and Scott Thede, a conservation warden based in Eau Claire. Also joining us on the phone now, we've got Bob Adrian. He is the owner of Rump's Butcher Shop in Altoona, the famous Rump's Butcher Shop. Bob Adrian, are you there? Oop, there we go. I didn't have you on. Bob, are you there?
Yep.
Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hey. So, first question is, how many deer do you process a year when it comes to gun deer or the season as a whole?
Well, I don't know the exact number of that, but it's hundreds.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. There's all the talk about the industry, Bob. There's a lot of people that are interested in how that industry is surviving.
Yeah. Well, the places like us, we guarantee your own meat back, so we take in small batches of. Yeah. Of boneless trim. Other places, you know, take in whole carcasses and do the whole thing from start to finish. So it's a you know, pretty big business throughout the state at all the different, you know, shops.
Conditions vary, of course, on opening weekend. It looks like from the weather reports it's going to be fairly warm in the 40s maybe, but possible rain and a little bit of snow. So we've seen that before, but and some years it's been extremely cold, bitter cold, and other years it's been very, very warm, warmer than predicted for this weekend. So some preparation tips starting out in the field, what would you suggest?
Well, first, you know, you're going to want to field dress the animal as soon as possible to start, you know, start cooling it down. If the temperatures are above 40 degrees, you're going to want to take some steps to try to get that carcass cooled down, whether it be, you know, if you have a, you know, somewhere to hang it that's cold, or if you can get the hide off and quarter it up and get into a refrigerator, or you can pack it in coolers with ice as long as you have a drain, you know, a drain plug on that to allow the ice to drain out as it's melting down. Some people even, you know, quarter them up and just put them in the freezer and then, you know, get at it, take a quarter out at a time, you know, throughout the winter or whenever when they have time to get at it, and then get it trimmed up that way.
Are we going to get in trouble with the warden here if we start quartering our deer? I guess we have to call it in first. Huh?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm not talking about in the field. I mean, once you get it registered and all of that, and get it out of the field, and then start that process.
There is a law that does allow for the cutting up of a deer up to five parts. What a head has to be attached to the main part of the deer yet, but. Yeah, get it tagged and registered, and then if it's more convenient to cut it up to help transport it out, you know, for those that hunt way back in the swamp, that is an option. You have to take everything out except for the entrails, of course, but, yeah, making it into fewer pieces sometimes helps.
Bob, at your end of things, talk about some of the unique ways venison can be packaged.
Yeah, well, first off, to bring in the trim, you know, once you do trim it up, if you're going to, you know, bring it into a facility like ours, or if you're going to store it, you're going to want to put it in a food-safe bag or container like Ziploc or a Tupperware, not garbage bags. I mean, we see everything, of course, you know. Garbage bags are made with some pretty nasty stuff that you don't want your food touching. So that's a start right there. The other thing is to really try to keep as much fat off of the product as you can. Venison fat is just not that palatable. And once you do that and you bring in nice, clean, you know, clean meat to us, the what we can make out of it is almost endless, you know, with brats and breakfast links and, you know, venison bacon, snack sticks, hot dogs, you know, we make over 200 items here so at the shop, so there's, you know, there's almost no end to what you can get made.
Bob, say it's 45 degrees and I shoot a deer and I hang him in the garage. How long now? Some places, at least with beef, they actually hang it for a few days to age it. Can I leave it in my garage for a couple of days if I'm busy hunting and don't want to get around to butchering that deer right away?
Yeah, you'd like to see under 40 degrees is the ideal, because over 40 degrees is where bacteria will start to grow. So 40 and under is the ideal, and then if you could hang it for 7 days and, you know, 40, 38 degrees, it would definitely be, you know, better.
This is how ignorant I am about this, but the letting it age, what, makes it more palatable, more tender?
Yep. Yeah, it starts, okay. You know, there's good bacteria that help break down the muscle and make it you know, more tender.
That's interesting.
Just like with beef, you know.
The deer, I always remember the deer being frozen solid when we would hang.
Yeah, it's hard to age them when it's, you know, 20 below zero.
And it's a lot easier to get the skin off if it's not frozen on, too. I found that from experience.
Sure.
Correct. Yeah, even just hanging them. You know, if you do take the hide off, you're going to get some dryness of the, you know, on the outside, yeah. which is all right. That can be trimmed off.
Do you find that many people bring stuff that you just can't touch?
Not very often. Most people that are going to go through the amount of work that's necessary to cut up and process deer usually know what they're doing. From time to time, you know, we get some stuff that we've, you know, you have to call somebody back and tell them, listen, you got to come and get this. We're not gonna mess with it. You know, leaves and dirt and things like that. But for the most part, most people, again, they want that meat. They've, you know, put a lot of effort in. They've spent money. You know, they definitely want a good product back. So we don't see that too often.
I'm just curious, Bob. I read somewhere that that Arby's restaurant. You know where I'm going with this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
At least in Minnesota, I think they're gonna for a very brief time gonna start offering venison on the menu. So do you feel like they're trying to beat you at your own game or something?
No, I just think they're trying to capitalize on a little market niche that I don't think it's gonna really go anywhere. You know, it's all farm raised product. And, you know, maybe in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, maybe those states that would probably fly, you know, the large deer hunting, you know, states. And, you know, I don't know. I it's still going to be fast food. You know what I mean?
Right.
We should maybe emphasize, since the warden's sitting right here, that there's pretty strict laws against commercial sales. If I go out and shoot a deer, if I go over to Marshmallow Lake and catch a bunch of bluegills and want to sell them to a local restaurant.
You can't do none of that. Yep.
Especially if the warden finds out I'm in pretty hot water.
Yeah. We do some wild game to restaurants and things like that, but that's all, you know, under inspection. Mm-hmm. from the farms, you know.
Sure.
You want to
see? Yeah. Well, sure, yeah.
Warden Thede.
By farms, captive deer farms, they raise a lot of venison, and that's the meat that's being sold. So, yeah, hunters, don't be selling your wild harvested game.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, and that's all in USDA, or is that the State Department of Agriculture that checks on that stuff that you sell at the? Because you sell venison year round, don't you, Bob?
For us, actually, we're just selling elk right now. Some elk and bison, not venison. It comes in under we get it from a federal processor, so. The farms, I'm not positive if it's a if it's an FDA regulated facility or USDA, one of the two. But that product then goes into, you know, a federally inspected facility for the slaughter, and then we buy the meat from federal inspected plants, and then we can in turn process that into different items, and then we can sell it retail or wholesale with the licensing that we carry here.
Okay. Here's a perennial question, and I'm sure everyone that hunts regularly knows what the answer is. But, you know, once you bring in your trimmed venison, what do you do with the carcass? Because I know plenty of people that are happy to just throw it in the woods, and that would drive my ma crazy when she would take the dogs for walks out in the woods, because the dogs would just go, they would have a buffet. But also, I would imagine there, with CWD being an issue, that could, mm-hmm. would be frowned upon.
I can Scott speak Thede. On that a bit. Well, the spread of chronic wasting disease has to be controlled by eliminating a lot of carcasses on the landscape, because potentially a carcass could be positive, you know, with CWD, and then it should not be left on the landscape. So there are rules in place as far as the whole wild deer carcass being moved throughout the state. It's you can only move it in from one chronic wasting disease area into another or an adjacent county. There are some exceptions. If, like meat processors or taxidermists, they can accept deer from around the state or even deer from outside of the state where potentially they could have chronic wasting disease, but only if the animal is moved within 72 hours of registering the animal. So you bring it in to Wisconsin, and within 72 hours it goes to a deer processor or a taxidermist. The point is the taxidermist and the deer processor have ways to dispose of these deer remains, the carcasses and stuff. And the landfilling is a common method, of course.
Sure.
So, again, if a hunter harvests a deer and it tests positive, we sure don't want that carcass dumped out on the landscape.
Do you know, are they collecting deer hides and deer carcasses again at Tower Ridge and down by Lake Eau Claire.
Warden Ken Thompson of Fall Creek usually coordinates that and works with the waste hauler. And, yep, I'm told there's some dumpsters at Tower Ridge and the Eau Claire County Park there north of Augusta, right, Lake Eau Claire.
Okay, yeah, kind of on the east side of Lake Eau Claire.
Yeah.
The attempt there is to keep people from dumping the carcasses in the county forest. Unfortunately, I live in that area, and they still they'll drive out just far enough so it looks like there's woods, and then unfortunately, often the plastic and cardboard goes along with the carcass.
Bob, in the meat that you process, do you find a lot of lead fragments?
Not really. Usually, you know, the grinder. You know, if there is in there, you know, we find them because the grinder finds them, but it's not very often that we do. Usually when someone's cutting up that meat, you know, those end up getting pulled out then, or you know, they just go through the animal, you know, and aren't even in the carcass at all. So we don't see it very often, a piece too. We get more, you know, like if we process goose meat and things like that, you know, we run into, or turkeys, you know, we run into some BBs, which are a little harder to find during the cutting up part of it, you know.
I hate to think what that would do to a grinder.
Yeah, steel shot is pretty tough on the plate and the blade. It's not very cooperative.
Oh. All right, well, Bob Adrian, owner of Rump's Meats, or Rump's Butcher Shop in Altoona, thanks for joining us. We're going to take our final break here. When we come back, we're going to speak with we'll wrap up the discussion. We'll speak with Tressie Camp of Midwest Environmental Advocates about a listening session to be held in Eau Claire. This is the West Side.
White nationalist Richard Spencer says his ideas got more attention than ever in the presidential campaign.
Our challenge now is to go beyond Trump.
So can he make his dream come true?
I want to be in a world where there are white societies, white nations, what could be called an ethnostate.
How's he going to do that? On the next Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Tonight at 7 on Wisconsin Public Radio. Support for WPR comes from Wollersheim Winery, featuring the holiday event A Vintage Christmas, Saturday, November 26th from 10 till 4, with wine tastings and Wisconsin cheeses. Complete details are at wollersheim.com.
You can benefit the VFW Unmet Needs Program while enjoying an evening of music, dance lessons, and good food at the second Hawthorne Hangar Dance, coming to the Chippewa Valley Regional Airport Saturday, December 3rd. Tickets at Gordy's Market locations in Eau Claire and in Chippewa Falls.
You're listening to The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rich Kramer. Thanks for joining us this Monday morning. We're talking about the 2016 deer season, the gun deer season, archery seasons as well. We just heard from Bob Adrian, owner of Rump's Butcher Shop in Altoona, still joined, I believe, by Mike Zechmeister of the DNR up in Spooner and Scott Thede of the DNR here in Eau Claire. 1-800-228-5615 is the number to call, and we're going to, in just one real brief moment, we're going to bring on Tressie Camp with Midwest Environmental Advocates. But I had a quick question for Warden Thede. Since people aren't wearing the back tags, does that mean that you're more likely to be stopped if you see a warden? Because otherwise you wouldn't know if they're
The back tags did provide an easy way for the warden to check a license. The back tag was, in fact, the license as well as the back tag numbers. So hunters, they'll have to show some proof that they have a license when approached by a warden. We can't confirm that from a distance like we used to. Also, I wanted to mention the e-registration. With the efficiency that Go Wild provides, you really got to remember not only your carcass tags and validating them, and why not attach them, you know, after you get the animal out of the woods? Then you're not going to forget, because you even have to have that. You do have to have the tag attached to the deer if it's hanging at camp or at your private house, in the garage. You're not there. You have to have the tag attached, and then yes, by 5 p.m. of the day after harvest. Get that deer registered online or by phone. Online is by far the most convenient, easy way to do it.
Right, and now you can go online with your phone. Yeah. Thank you for that. So now let's turn to Tressie Camp. She's an attorney with Midwest Environmental Advocates based in Madison, and she's joining us now. Welcome to the program, Tressie.
Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. Thank you for joining us. Now, there's going to be a listening session in Eau Claire. That's this Thursday. or excuse me, I might have gotten the day wrong. There's an Eau Claire, there's a listening session in Eau Claire this week, correct?
Correct. It's actually tomorrow, Tuesday evening, 5 to 7 p.m.
5 to 7 p.m.
At the Technical Center on Claremont.
At CVTC. Yeah. So who are we going to, who's going to be listening?
Who's going to be listening? So I think the key is that we have Robert or Bob Kaplan, who's the regional administrator out of EPA's Chicago office. So we have some pretty high-level regional staff coming to hear citizens' concerns. I believe he's also bringing some other leadership among his staff, the water program director, if I recall correctly, although, of course, you know, those plans can change, but definitely Bob Kaplan will be there and leadership out of EPA Region 5 Chicago.
All right, and a reminder, anyone listening to the program right now, if you've got questions or comments about the deer season or about this listening session tomorrow, give us a call, 1-800-228-5615.
Why Eau Claire, why now? This is Dave Carlson up at the Eau Claire.
Why Eau Claire, why now? I think the location was chosen as a somewhat central focal point where we weren't necessarily cutting off folks from far north or, you know, southeast or southwest Wisconsin. So really just a meeting point for everyone. Why now is a good question. I think we've really, you know, we've really kind of reached a boiling point. As I was preparing to chat with you all today, you know, it's a long list, but I'll start broadly. You know, really, it's an opportunity to discuss a growing list of concerns that citizens have regarding water quantity and water quality issues throughout the state of Wisconsin. My organization, Midwest Environmental Advocates, is primarily involved because of an ongoing petition that we filed with EPA about a year ago, asking them to take a look at the way that DNR issues water pollution permits. But certainly that's not the only reason folks are attending. You know, we have issues ranging folks coming from the Lake Peatonwell area where you have one of, I believe, the top 10 algal blooms of concern at EPA. You have folks coming more from the Milwaukee area with concerns about lead pipes. So it really is, it's a fairly broad listening session, although the audience will be there really to voice water quantity and quality concerns to Bob Kaplan and his team at EPA.
That's not to mention also the impaired waters concerns on Lake Tainer and Lake Manoman to our west, and the Chippewa River and the city of Eau Claire having problems with its sewage pipes and breaking during construction and spewing hundreds of thousands of gallons, millions of gallons of waste into the Chippewa River.
And unfortunately, I think we're going to hear a number of stories. You know, it's fortunate that the citizens get their chance to tell those stories. It's unfortunate that we have stories like that. You know, really, there's not one part of the state right now, you know, that can claim that has the best or the worst water quality, you know, water quality status. Our impaired waters list is growing every year, and I don't have the list in front of me, but I believe between 2014 and 2016, the impaired waters list, at least 200-some water bodies were added to that list, and that's a list our state submits to EPA. So it really is a statewide issue of concern right now.
Now, Tracy, you mentioned the petitions that MEA filed, which led to the Environmental Protection Agency sending some folks to Madison. I believe there was someone looking at records at the DNR. But is this listening session directly related to that petition?
You know, I really hope that folks consider this as a more broad listening session. So I'm really proud that we have petitioners. So the petition I mentioned, there were 16 folks from around the state who filed that. We do have representatives and MEA staff that will be there. But one reason that we are asking EPA, high-level EPA regional staff to come is that they have, you know, the jurisdiction and the ability to hear a broader array of concerns, whereas there were some legal and technical experts who did the permit file review that you mentioned. Mm. So this is a broader audience in terms of citizen involvement, and also just kind of a broader higher level audience that EPA is sending.
What will the impact be? What will they be looking for, and how will they use it?
So I think it could go a number of directions. The main impact that I see is I've already heard from a number of people that will be submitting written comments either in addition to or instead of attending in person. So I think the main result that EPA will have, but also any Wisconsinite who wants to have kind of a source of all of these stories gathered in one place, you know, I think it's going to be a unique opportunity to collect testimonials from citizens around the state to use as we go into the next legislative session, this next budget session. You know, there are a lot of big water quality decisions that are coming up at the state and federal level here in the next year or so. So I see the biggest impact as really just a unique, you know, direct opportunity for discussion as between the general public here in Wisconsin and our leadership at EPA in Chicago.
Tracy, are you hoping that the EPA will step in and override the permit writing that DNR is now doing in some cases?
Well, that's the legal backstop that we asked for when we filed the petition for corrective action about a year ago. But certainly both to the media and in our communications with EPA, we highlight our awareness and understanding that petitions like this filed in other states have never resulted in that power being taken away. And, you know, we can still claim at the DNR to have a lot of really amazing scientific experts at the program staff level. Those are the people who have the expertise and really deserve to be the ones writing those permits. But we've reached a place where we need political will at the higher end. So my hope is not that EPA will take power away, but that the combination of all of this public input and EPA authority will cause kind of top-down political will to give the good program staff that write the permits and issue them really the ability that they need to go back to writing permits that comply with federal law, specifically the Clean Water Act.
That's 5 to 7 tomorrow. That's 5 to 7 tomorrow, Tuesday at Chippewa Valley Technical College in Eau Claire.
And if you are going to talk, you need to register in advance, I believe.
All right. Well, that is our time. I appreciate it. Tracy Camp, thank you so much for joining us. She's an attorney with Midwest Environmental Advocates in Madison. Many thanks to Bob Adrian, also owner of Rump's Butcher Shop in Altoona. Scott Thede, conservation warden for the DNR based in Eau Claire. Thank you very much. And Mike Zechmeister, of course, wildlife biologist and Northern Region Program Manager for Wisconsin DNR up in Spooner. Thank you. Joe Knight and Dave Carlson, I appreciate it. Good to see you again. Have a safe and productive week. We'll chat again next Monday morning. We'll be talking about an upcoming poverty summit led by Clear Vision Eau Claire. I'm Rich Kramer.